In a world where abortion is illegal, but unwinding teenagers is perfectly acceptable, Neil Schusterman's dystopian masterpiece Unwind forces us to confront uncomfortable questions about bodily autonomy, the value of human life, and what it truly means to exist. Published in 2007, this haunting novel has developed a cult following among young adult readers and educators alike, with Stephen King praising its unforgettable premise and John Green citing it as inspiration for his own work. What makes Unwind particularly chilling is how plausibly Schusterman constructs his dystopia. The practice of harvesting teenagers for their body parts emerges not from some distant future technology, but from a slight extension of medical capabilities we already possess, combined with a society willing to embrace horrifying ethical compromises in the name of pragmatism. In the aftermath of the Second Civil War, known as the Heartland War, America emerges scarred from a brutal conflict fought over reproductive rights. The resulting compromise, the Bill of Life, represents one of the most ethically complex and disturbing constitutional amendments in this alternate history. The amendment establishes an untouchable sanctity of human life from conception until age 13, but then introduces a chilling loophole. Between 13 and 18, parents can choose to retroactively abort their child through a process called unwinding, where the teenager is systematically dismantled for their body parts. The government justifies this practice through a perverse technicality. Since 100% of the body must be used for transplantation, they argue the child doesn't technically die, but lives on in a divided state. This macabre compromise satisfies both pro-life and pro-choice factions by essentially deferring the abortion debate into adolescence. Pro-life advocates can claim victory in protecting fetal rights, while pro-choice supporters maintain bodily autonomy through delayed termination rights. The war ends, but in its place emerges a society where teenagers live in constant fear of being unwound, a fate that disproportionately affects society's most vulnerable youth. Schusterman's genius lies in his meticulous world-building that shows how society gradually normalizes this horrific practice. Through carefully crafted euphemisms, harvest camps instead of termination facilities, unwinding rather than execution, the culture sanitizes its actions. Religious institutions even embrace the practice, reframing it as a holy sacrifice. Economic incentives further entrench the system, as the medical industry profits enormously from the steady supply of young, healthy organs and tissues. Parents are consoled by the comforting fiction that their children aren't really dying, but merely living differently through their distributed parts. The system creates a devastating hierarchy of disposable youth, each category reflecting different societal failures. State wards face unwinding due to budget cuts, revealing how economic pressures override human dignity. Troubled teens, often struggling with mental health or behavioral issues, are discarded by frustrated parents who view unwinding as a convenient solution. Most disturbing are the tithes, children raised from birth by religious families specifically to be unwound as a sacred offering, representing the ultimate perversion of faith to justify systematic violence. These categories mirror real-world parallels in how societies determine human value through economic utility, behavioral compliance, and religious doctrine. The Bill of Life serves as a dark mirror to contemporary debates about bodily autonomy, youth rights, and the ways institutions can normalize even the most extreme forms of social control through careful manipulation of language, belief, and economic incentives. The story follows three teenagers whose paths intersect as they flee their scheduled unwindings. Connor Lassiter, a troubled 16-year-old whose parents have given up on controlling his temper, discovers his unwinding order and runs away. His desperate flight across a highway leads him to kidnap Lev Calder, a 13-year-old tithe being driven to his unwinding ceremony by his parents and pastor. Meanwhile, Risa Ward, a ward of the state and talented pianist, learns she's being unwound due to budget cuts despite her abilities. When her transport bus crashes after nearly hitting Connor and Lev crossing the road, she seizes her chance to escape. The three become unlikely allies in their quest for survival. What makes these characters compelling is how they represent different facets of the unwinding system. Connor is the rebellious teen whose parents choose the easy solution rather than working through his behavioral issues. Risa embodies the cold economic calculations that determine a state ward's worth. And Lev, perhaps most heartbreaking of all, has been raised since birth to believe his unwinding is a sacred honor, that his highest purpose is to be dismembered so others might benefit from his parts. Their initial interactions are fraught with tension. Connor and Risa view Lev as brainwashed, while Lev sees his kidnappers as criminals interfering with his holy purpose. This dynamic creates a fascinating exploration of how different upbringings shape our perception of morality and self-worth. Can Lev unlearn a lifetime of conditioning? Can Connor control the impulsivity that led to his unwinding order? Can Risa prove her value in a world that's already deemed her disposable? As Connor, Risa, and Lev navigate their new reality as fugitives, they encounter a modern underground railroad for AWOL unwinds. This network of safe houses, sympathetic adults, and transportation systems reveals that not everyone accepts the practice of unwinding, despite its widespread acceptance in mainstream society. One of their first encounters with this network comes through a teacher named Hannah Steinberg, who risks her career to help them escape police at a high school. She directs them to an antique shop run by Sonia, who hides unwinds in her basement before sending them to a mysterious place called the Graveyard. In Sonia's basement, they meet other runaways with equally heartbreaking stories. There's Hayden, whose divorcing parents couldn't agree on custody, so they decided they'd rather have him unwound than let the other parent have him. "If you could harness the energy of my parents' spite," Hayden tells them, "you could power a small city for several years." Despite his affected rich kid demeanor, there's something about Hayden that makes it impossible not to like him. Mai is the fourth of four girls born to parents who kept trying for a boy until they finally got one. Roland, perhaps the most dangerous of the group, had dreams of joining the military, but got into too many fights at school. What got him unwound was beating up his abusive stepfather. His mother took her husband's side, and while the stepfather got off with a warning, Roland was sent to be unwound. These stories serve as powerful indictments of how society discards children for convenience, spite, or simple economics. The underground network that tries to save them represents the moral conscience that persists even in a dystopian world. People who recognize the horror of unwinding despite its normalization. After a harrowing journey between various safe houses, Connor, Risa, and their fellow unwinds finally reach the Graveyard, a vast airplane boneyard stretching across the Arizona desert where thousands of decommissioned military and civilian aircraft rest in neat rows under the scorching sun. Here, they encounter the enigmatic Admiral, a commanding presence in a meticulously maintained naval uniform who has created a hidden sanctuary for hundreds of AWOL unwinds. His operation provides refuge until these teens reach 18, the age when unwinding becomes legally impossible. The Admiral transforms this collection of frightened, desperate teenagers into a structured community through military precision and organizational skill. He divides them into specialized work teams. Maintenance crews repair aircraft, salvage teams strip valuable parts, security patrols guard the perimeter, and medical units tend to injuries. His infamous 10 Commandments govern every aspect of life, from mandatory work shifts to strict curfews and behavioral codes. These rules, while restrictive, create the stability many of these teens never experienced in their previous lives. Risa discovers her calling in the medical unit, where her natural healing abilities and calm demeanor make her invaluable. Connor, however, struggles to find his place. His leadership potential conflicts with his quick temper, causing tension as he navigates the complex social hierarchy that has evolved among the unwinds. The constant pressure of living in hiding takes its toll on everyone, manifesting in different ways. Some become withdrawn, others aggressive, and many form tight-knit family-like bonds. The graveyard itself becomes a powerful metaphor, a place where discarded things and unwanted people find new purpose. Among the sun-bleached fuselages and stripped engines, teenagers learn trades, form relationships, and rediscover their worth. Yet it's also a gilded cage, forcing them to hide from a society that deemed them disposable. The desert isolation and constant vigilance create a pressure cooker atmosphere, where rumors and suspicions flourish. The Admiral's true nature remains a source of speculation until Connor confronts him about disturbing whispers suggesting he's secretly unwinding teens himself. In an emotional confrontation, the Admiral reveals his devastating personal connection to unwinding. His son Harlan, who became known in urban legends as Humphrey Dunphy, was unwound as political revenge after the Admiral, one of the original architects of the Unwind Accord, had a change of heart and tried to prevent its implementation. The dentures he wears, modeled after his son's teeth, serve as a constant reminder of his failure to protect his own child. This personal tragedy transformed him from a system enabler into its secret opponent, dedicating his remaining years to protecting other people's children from the fate he couldn't prevent for his own. His story exemplifies how direct exposure to unwinding's horror can transform even its strongest supporters into its fiercest opponents. While Connor and Risa find temporary safety at the graveyard, Lev's journey takes a darker and more psychologically complex turn. After his calculated escape from Connor and Risa, whom he initially viewed as kidnappers corrupting his sacred purpose, he encounters Cyrus Sci-Fi Finch, a troubled teenager whose identity has been fractured by an unwinding procedure. Sci-Fi received a temporal lobe transplant from an unwind who suffered from kleptomania, and his struggle becomes a living testament to the disturbing reality of unwinding's psychological consequences. He experiences not just the donor's compulsive urges to steal, but also fragments of memories and personality traits that were never his own, raising profound questions about consciousness, identity, and the true nature of the soul. Their journey to Joplin, Missouri becomes both a physical and spiritual pilgrimage. Sci-Fi seeks closure with his donor's family, hoping to understand the foreign impulses that now plague his mind. For Lev, who was raised to believe in the divine purpose of tithing, watching Sci-Fi's internal battle creates the first serious cracks in his ideological foundation. The confrontation with the donor's parents proves catastrophic to Lev's worldview. Their casual dismissal of their son's humanity, their bureaucratic justification for unwinding him over petty theft, strips away Lev's remaining illusions about the system's righteousness. This disillusionment creates a dangerous vacuum in Lev's psyche. Having lost his faith in both the tithing system and broader society, he becomes susceptible to radical ideologies. The Clappers, teenage terrorists who transform their own bodies into weapons through blood replacement with explosive compounds, offer Lev a new purpose born of rage rather than faith. Their philosophy of violent resistance appeals to his shattered worldview, transforming his former religious fervor into revolutionary zeal. By the time Lev infiltrates Happy Jack Harvest Camp, he has completed a devastating transformation. The once devout tithe who viewed his unwinding as a blessed sacrifice now carries death in his veins, planning to destroy the very institution he once revered. His character arc serves as a stark warning about the dangers of absolute certainty and the vulnerability of faith to disillusionment. Through Lev's eyes, readers witness how systemic injustice and moral betrayal can transform devotion into destruction. The poetry of his transformation is captured in his reflection that he becomes full of gems yet void of light, so nothing sparkles, nothing shines. A metaphor for how his inner radiance has been replaced by a dangerous darkness. his journey from faithful tithe to would-be martyr forces readers to confront uncomfortable parallels with real-world radicalization and the thin line between religious devotion and extremist ideology. The final act takes place at Happy Jack Harvest Camp, where Connor, Risa, and Roland are sent after being captured. Schusterman's description of the facility is chilling, precisely because of how ordinary it appears. With its pastel colors, Hawaiian-shirted staff, and recreational activities, it resembles a summer camp rather than a slaughterhouse. The basketball courts, swimming pools, and art rooms create an atmosphere of leisure that masks the facility's true purpose. Even the name, Happy Jack, suggests warmth and friendliness, demonstrating how language can be weaponized to obscure horror. This facade of normalcy represents the book's most powerful commentary on how societies normalize atrocities. The harvest counselors speak in carefully crafted euphemisms, never acknowledging that unwinding means death. They refer to the process as transition or fulfilling one's potential, while surgical rooms are called donation chambers. The red carpet that leads to the chop shop is presented as an honor rather than a final walk to dismemberment. Even the band that plays cheerful music on the roof, including Risa on keyboard, serves to mask the horror happening below. The music becomes particularly poignant when readers realize it's deliberately timed to cover the sounds of screams. The tithes, including Lev, who has infiltrated their ranks as part of his bombing plot, are kept separate from the terribles, regular unwinds, receiving better accommodations and treatment. They stay in private rooms with better furnishings, eat higher quality food, and receive preferential treatment from staff. This caste system further divides potential allies, making resistance more difficult by creating hierarchy among the victims. The tithes themselves often look down on regular unwinds, having internalized the belief that their sacrifice is holy, while others are merely troublemakers getting their just desserts. The most haunting passage in the book comes when Roland is taken for unwinding. Schusterman takes us through the entire 3-hour procedure from Roland's perspective as he remains conscious while being systematically dismantled. His thoughts gradually fragment as sections of his brain are removed, regressing to childhood memories until nothing remains. The clinical precision of the medical team contrasts sharply with the fundamental horror of their actions. They maintain professional detachment while methodically disassembling a conscious human being, checking off body parts on clipboards as if conducting inventory. This unforgettable scene forces readers to confront the reality behind the euphemisms. Unwinding is murder, regardless of how society frames it. The procedure's careful preservation of body parts does nothing to mitigate its fundamental immorality. The harvest camp section serves as a powerful allegory for how societies can normalize even the most horrific practices through bureaucracy, euphemism, and the thin veneer of civility. By making the unthinkable seem routine and even pleasant, the system perpetuates itself while dulling the moral sensibilities of both its perpetrators and victims. The climax unfolds in the sterile corridors of the chop shop when Mai and Blaine, Lev's fellow clappers, initiate their devastating attack. Their bodies, infused with explosive chemicals that detonate upon rapid clapping, transform the surgical facility into ground zero. The explosion coincides precisely with Connor's scheduled unwinding, creating a chaotic inferno that shatters the facility's methodical operation. The blast destroys surgical suites, collapses corridors, and obliterates the careful system designed to process unwinds efficiently and quietly. In this moment of destruction, Lev faces his defining choice. Despite months of preparation and indoctrination into the clapper ideology, he chooses humanity over martyrdom. Instead of detonating himself, he turns his efforts to rescue work, pulling survivors from the smoking ruins. A decision that transforms him from potential terrorist to unexpected hero. His choice represents a profound rejection of the violent resistance that had seduced him earlier. The explosion's aftermath reveals the complex cost of survival. Connor emerges alive, but fundamentally changed, having lost both an arm and an eye in the blast. In a twist of fate that borders on cruel irony, he receives transplants that include Roland's arm, complete with its distinctive shark tattoo, a permanent reminder of his complex relationship with his former adversary. This physical merger of Connor and Roland serves as a powerful symbol of how unwinding has blurred the lines between identity and bodily autonomy. Reese's fate proves equally challenging, but leads to a different kind of resistance. The explosion leaves her paralyzed from the waist down, facing a choice between accepting parts from an unwind or remaining in her wheelchair. She chooses the latter, weaponizing her disability as a form of protest. Her decision exploits a legal loophole that protects disabled individuals from unwinding, transforming her injury into a shield against the very system that caused it. Lev's survival and choice create ripples throughout society. As the clapper who didn't clap, he becomes a powerful symbol of resistance and redemption. His story catalyzes nationwide protests against unwinding, forcing the first serious congressional debates about reform. The possibility of lowering the age of adulthood to 17 emerges as a concrete policy proposal, a change that could save countless potential unwinds. While his parents maintain their rejection, his brother Marcus's petition for guardianship offers hope for personal healing along social change. The story concludes with Connor assuming the identity of E. Robert Mullard, a deceased guard, and returning to the graveyard to continue the Admiral's mission. His experience has taught him the futility of violent resistance, leading him to develop sophisticated strategies of nonviolent opposition. As Risa creates music from her wheelchair, her art a form of protest itself, they envision a future where unwinding might be relegated to history's darker chapters. Their relationship, tested by trauma but strengthened through survival, represents hope for both personal and societal transformation. Throughout the novel, Schusterman weaves profound philosophical questions about consciousness, identity, and the nature of the soul. If every part of you continues to live in someone else, are you really dead? If memories and personality traits can be transferred through transplanted tissue, what constitutes the essence of a person? These questions come to a head in a powerful scene at the Dunphy Ranch, where all recipients of the Admiral's son's unwound parts gather. As they interact, their individual memories begin to coalesce into a unified consciousness. Harlan's memories and personality emerge through their collective voices, creating a moment when they all respond as one to the Admiral's call, "Harlan?" This scene suggests that consciousness might be more distributed throughout the body than we realize, challenging the brain-centric view of personhood. It also raises disturbing implications about unwinding. If the unwound person's consciousness persists in some fragmented form, is unwinding actually a form of eternal torment rather than death? The teenagers in the story debate these questions themselves in a memorable scene in a transport crate. Hayden shares a story about a girl who believed unwinds never had souls to begin with, suggesting God knows who will be unwound and doesn't give them souls. Diego counters that souls come from love. A person don't got a soul until that person is loved. Connor considers his own parents, who once loved him but signed the unwinding order, wondering if part of his soul died then. When pressed for his own opinion on when life begins, Hayden simply admits, "I don't know," a response Connor finds more honest than any other answer. This philosophical humility stands in stark contrast to the certainty with which society has implemented the practice of unwinding. What makes unwind so disturbing is not its fantastical elements, but its plausibility. The practice of unwinding emerges from recognizable social forces: religious extremism, parental authority, economic pragmatism, and the human tendency to use euphemistic language to mask moral horrors. Schusterman even includes references to real-world atrocities, like Ukrainian babies allegedly harvested for parts, reminding us that fiction is often one rationalization away from reality. the novel forces us to examine how we determine which lives have value in our own society. Do we measure worth by productivity, convenience, or conformity? Do we discard those who are difficult or expensive to care for? Do we use euphemisms to distance ourselves from the moral implications of our choices? These questions remain urgently relevant 15 years after the book's publication. As medical technology advances, as economic inequality grows, and as political divisions deepen, Unwind serves as a warning about where compromise without moral foundation can lead us. It reminds us that the most dangerous dystopias aren't those that arise from alien invasions or supernatural disasters, but those we build ourselves through a series of seemingly reasonable compromises. In the end, Unwind is a powerful testament to the resilience of the human spirit in the face of dehumanization. Through Connor, Risa, and Lev, we see that even in the darkest circumstances, people can reclaim their agency, form meaningful connections, and fight for a more just world. Their struggle reminds us that systems of oppression depend on our compliance, and that resistance, even when it seems futile, is essential to maintaining our humanity.